Chapter 6. Swimming to Juvie. My dad encouraged mischief. He'd make Mary and me pretend to answer fake phone calls. He wanted us to be utterly convincing. We called it the telephone game. He showed us how to do it first, how to make it real. Then it was our turn. I'd answer, "Shannon residence, this is Molly." "Uh-huh." "Yeah." "He's right here." "Freeze." "Stop," he'd say. "Start over." That seemed fake. So I would try again. "Hello?" "Yeah." "Oh, no, I'm here with my dad." "Uh-huh." "No, it's no bother. Yeah. Okay. Sure, I'll put him on." "Better." I got so good I could really trick friends when they came over, even though they never really heard the phone ringing. "Hello?" "Hello, yeah, Allison? Allison Earl? Yeah, she's here. You want to talk to her?" "Okay, shh." "Oh, I won't say anything." I give Allison a, like, this is weird look. Like, what is this person talking about? To kind of draw her in, to make it mysterious. Who is this calling for Allison? It had to be 100% real, no acting. It was the best exercise, the best training, and how I first developed my skills. It was the Jim Shannon School of Real Acting. On Christmas and his birthday, our dad didn't want gifts. He wanted cash. Mary and I would compete to see how much we could hand over. I'd ask Mary, "How much are you going to give him?" "$200. "Shit, I'm only giving him $150. And when we gave him our money, he'd say, "Thank you," like that was his due. When he was supposed to treat our friends to a meal, he'd tell us, "I don't want to have to pay for your friends." We would beg him, "Don't take money from our friends. Please, just treat them, please, because their parents treat us when they take us out to restaurants." But if a kid ever held up some money to pay saying, "Oh, here, Mr. Shannon, take this," he would snatch it, snap, really quickly. And that was it. The money was his. And we would be so embarrassed. To prevent that from happening, we started to give him our babysitting money ahead of time so we could make it look like he was paying for our friends. As I got older, scams began to interest me on my own. I saw that they had potential. I started trying to think of fast ways to make money. One Christmas, I realized caroling for charity. Ooh, singing with a cup. I told Allison my idea, and together one snowy night, we knocked on doors, sang Silent Night, told people we were donating to some made-up charity, and just took their money. And we made a wad of cash. We went house to house and ended up making about $200. And then we went and sat at the bar of this hotel restaurant on Chagrin Boulevard and ordered Coca-Colas to celebrate. I thought going into people's living rooms at Christmas time and putting on a little holiday show is the easiest way to make some fast cash. One day when Ann and I were babysitting, we decided, hey, let's get this cute little 3-year-old boy a new outfit. So we took him downtown, changed him right there in the aisle at Higbee's, and walked out with free clothing. It was so easy. Then I decided to shoplift my own bra. I was too embarrassed to ask my dad to take me to get one, so Ann and I went and stole bras downtown at the May Company. And then my dad saw me with the bra and gave me this questioning look. I said, oh, our gymnastics teacher actually said it was a requirement for gymnastics, and he gave us these. He just said, oh, okay. I felt embarrassed because it was so girly, and I just knew it was something a mom should do for a daughter. To be a successful shoplifter, you just had to act like you weren't doing anything wrong. It was acting. We would take a huge bag and shoplift our way through a store, taking whatever we wanted, even asking salespeople for help finding things. We used to call it swimming. One summer afternoon, sitting on our porch, I asked Ann, hey, do you want to go swimming? My dad had given us the Aqua Chevy Malibu convertible. Ann replied, yeah, let's go swimming. We both said, back to school shopping. So we drove to Value City and just loaded up on stuff. We brought big purses in. After stealing as much as we could carry, we went through the checkout line to each buy something cheap. It was a big haul. We had really stolen a lot. Anne went through the line first and was exiting the store as I paid for the little token thing I had brought up to the register. And just as I was thinking, oh good, I'm going to make it, a huge security guy clapped his hand on my shoulder and said, come with me. He had leaned across all these shoppers in the checkout line to grab me. I thought, fuck. A As I watched Anne make it to the car, I kept thinking, she'd better be caught with me. I just didn't want to be by myself. The security guy took me in the back and began interrogating me. He said, "We know what you did." I was a punky, tough kid into the whole idea of bad girls and juvenile detention. To me, it seemed like fun being in that sort of trouble. I looked at the security guy and thought, "Fuck you, you don't fucking scare me." I wasn't afraid. I thought he was a real asshole. I said, "Arrest me." So he called the cops. Then I said, "Okay, so we stole, we're bad kids, go ahead, handcuff me." Meanwhile, out in the parking lot, it was dawning on Anne that maybe I'd been caught, and she was saying to herself, "Oh shit, shit, where's Molly, where's Molly? Oh my God, oh my God." And in heart-pounding terror, she got in the car and started quickly hiding what she'd stolen under the seats. Then, boom, two police cruisers surrounded her, and the cops started pulling stuff out of the Malibu and asking, "Do you have receipts for this?" She said, "I was just..." She got pulled out of the car and brought back to where I was. Yay! The thought of juvenile detention truly excited me. I thought, yeah, I want to be with them bad girls. This is so fun. Me and Anne are bad together. The whole thing was very exciting. Maybe we'll go to jail or to juvie. I wanted to go. I felt excited and curious about it. We went to the police station and got fingerprinted. They put us in different rooms. Anne called her mom. Through the walls, I heard her say, "Hi, Mom, it's Anne." Then answering her mom's question, she wailed, "Police station. Shoplifting!" Her cry reverberated through the place. Then my dad arrived to get us, and the sound of him walking with his leg brace echoed through the halls. He taught us to be wild, but now he was pissed that we'd taken it that far. After that, Anne and I were banned from going to stores together, and they made us go to Shoplifters Anonymous meetings, which we just thought was hysterical. We loved it. As long as we could be together, it was all great. Shoplifters Anonymous was even funner than shoplifting. I remember thinking it was so funny going to meetings and sharing with other bad girls. But it wasn't funny. Mr. O'Neill happened to be in the hospital at the time recovering from some routine surgery, and we went to visit him. My dad had already told him what had happened. When I walked into Mr. O'Neill's hospital room, he looked at me disappointed and just said, "Oh, Molly." And I felt so ashamed. I never did steal again after that. Chapter 7, The Lullaby of Broadway. For a long time, I used to have fantasies about being signed by a big New York City talent manager. I thought that from the moment a manager signed me, I would, of course, eat only salads because I would, as a professional actress, have to be very concerned with keeping myself fit. My fantasy was that I would be signed by a manager, eat lots of healthy green salads, and become a professional actress. When the all-new Mickey Mouse Club came to Ohio, my dad said, "You should audition." He drove Mary Ann and me all the way across town. But we missed the Mickey Mouse Club audition, and somehow I wound up auditioning for something completely different that I thought was the all-new Mickey Mouse Club. It was an audition. I did have to sing a song. There was a piano, and I went right into Tea for Two. When I was done, they said, "We want you." I still thought it was the all-new Mickey Mouse Club. But it was something called The Little Rascals or The New Little Rascals, this terrible show that went around to carnivals and Greek restaurants. It was that low budget. And the woman who was in charge of my group was another hard drinker. Being in the new Little Rascals was still kind of good because I got to get up in front of an audience and I would sing and people would stay and listen. It was good practice getting to perform live, but it was a crappy show. I really thought that I'd gotten into the all-new Mickey Mouse Club instead of some local, dumpy carnival and restaurant Little Rascals thing. My dad drove me all across town to perform in these shows. One time we were in a backyard getting ready for a performance, and the woman who ran it was wobbly drunk at 10 o'clock in the morning. I was riveted. I was so much more interested in studying her as a character and thinking about her and getting an opportunity to follow her and watch her than I was in singing Tea for Two. I could not take my eyes off of her. She fascinated me. I thought to myself, this is the lady who's calling the shots? This is not good. This is worth everything. There were only 6 or 7 of us in the group. One of the girls was named Connie, and her mother would help me get ready because she knew I didn't have a mother. Connie's mom sewed red sparkles on the white polyester one-piece jumpsuit / short sets we had to wear so we all looked the same. We also had to wash our hair before the shows. I distinctly remember Connie's mom washing my hair backstage, and when she touched my head, I thought, oh my God, I love this. These are the things I like about showbiz. It had been so many years since a lady or anyone had washed my hair. The braces on my dad's legs kept him from walking upstairs to give us baths. This is why I had the dirty neck, though he loved taking us to Dominic's, the hip new Beechwood hair salon, to get us Pixies or Dorothy Hamill haircuts. After the new Little Rascals, I auditioned for Heights Youth Theater, a fantastic group that did big musicals like Alice in Wonderland and Oliver for giant local audiences filled with families and kids. It was a very professional, almost pre-Broadway theater group. Originally, the shows were in a theater at Wiley School in University Heights. Then they moved to the Front Row, a 3,200-seat theater in the round where comedians and musical acts like Joan Rivers, Richard Pryor, Bob Marley, and the Jackson 5 performed. When I auditioned and got the lead part of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, it was significant, not just because these were giant productions with sold-out audiences, but because almost everyone else was older, 17, almost adults, while I was 11. Many of us went on to professional careers. Our piano player for The Wizard of Oz was Jim Brickman, Jimmy, who'd later record 5 gold records. Heights Youth Theater was this big arts organization with the best kids in Cleveland auditioning, and I started getting recognized around town. I would go to the shoe store and little kids would come up to me and say, "That's the girl who plays Dorothy." I had a big, thick script to memorize. I loved the smell of the mimeographed pages that they gave us on the first day of rehearsal. And there was this big professional costume fitting. The girl who played Dorothy before me was 18, and since I was so much younger and littler, they had to take in the dress a lot, especially in the boobs. The prior Dorothy was basically a woman. But what I liked best about acting was that the theater kids were really affectionate. I was in 5th grade and had been in Catholic school till then. I was meeting these other kids at Heights Youth Theater from predominantly Jewish backgrounds. Oh, I thought, there's a really big difference between Jewish kids and Catholic kids, though I wasn't sure if it was because they were theater kids or because they were Jewish, but these were my people. All the kids were just so warm. We would all braid each other's hair. We would have massage chains. There was all this touching. That's really what drew me into showbiz. Everyone sitting on the floor in a group, giving massages as the girls brushed and braided and played with each other's hair. I just loved the way everyone was so affectionate. The warmth that I was missing from a mother I got from these theater kids and their affection. I thought, this is pure heaven. And then I met the boy who played the Scarecrow, the only other cast member my age, and I fell madly in love. His name was George Cheeks, and I'm still so close to him. George was half African-American and half Greek. His mom's side is related to George Stephanopoulos. His parents divorced when he was little, and his mom, Jenny Cheeks, was a famous DJ for WMMS, Cleveland's big rock station. George had that same charisma, and he wanted to kiss me. I had such a crush on him. One time, my dad and sister and I bumped into him behind the Dairy Queen where they had this giant slide, and he asked me if I wanted to go down in a potato sack with him. I was nervous about doing it, but my dad said, "Go!" In the summertime, George and I went swimming in Lake Erie, and he said to me, "Let's take our clothes off together." I thought, oh my God, take off my clothes? Oh, my beating heart. We kissed underwater. I really to this day believe that kids can fall in love because I felt such deep love for George. I had never felt anything like that before. Mary and I had gone to formal class at a place called Mrs. Batzer's Dancing School. It was a pre-cotillion thing for the rich kids, but our dad got us in. The boys would wear jackets and ties and sit on one side of the room, and the girls wore white gloves and pretty dresses and sat on the other side. The boys would always cross the room and ask the girls to dance. A piano player named Bubbles played while we danced the foxtrot. And then we would have fancy parties at country clubs with boy-girl dances. There was this one chubby boy called Mickey Covington who would always make a beeline to me and say, "May I have this dance?" And I thought, "Mickey Covington again?" Because he would always pick me. Always, consistently, for the 3 years of dancing school, he asked me to dance. And I would think, "All right, fine," while looking over his head at some other boy across the dance floor and thinking, "I wish that boy would ask me to dance." But then finally, during a bachelor's party at a country club after dancing with Mickey, we went and sat with my friends and had some Cokes. I was really comfortable and we were laughing and talking, and I realized, I think I really like this Mickey Covington. He's so sweet and he's so thoughtful. Good manners. He's a good conversationalist. He asks me questions about myself. I ask him questions. I just feel so comfortable. And if I didn't give a shit what anybody thought, I would just enjoy having a Coke right here with Mickey Covington. He likes me. I like him. There is nowhere I want to be right now, but right here with Mickey. Just embrace the guy who likes you, who adores you, who consistently comes after you. Don't go look for the guy over there who's not paying attention to you or the guy you have to chase after. And I brought some of that same feeling to my relationship with George, that comfort, which is why when the romance was over, we stayed close. George had introduced me to one of his best friends, Debbie Palermo. The three of us became a trio. Debbie went to public school in Cleveland Heights with George, but then George transferred in 10th grade to the private school where I went after St. Dominic's, Hawkins School, where the ratio of boys to girls was something like 70-30. So it was a big deal to get in if you were a girl. They offered me a great financial aid package. The whole atmosphere was very preppy and there was a lot of homework. Hawkins also had a foreign exchange program, and I stayed in Paris in the spring of my sophomore year. Then two French exchange students, Amélie and Béatrice, lived with us the following summer. Amélie was cool and Beatrice was kind of nerdy, but they were both very French and came from these upper-class families. Amélie lived in a mansion on one of the fanciest boulevards in Paris. In Paris, I was supposed to stay with Beatrice and live in our family's houseboat on the Seine, but she had cats and I was allergic, so I stayed with the woman who ran the exchange program instead. I learned how to speak French by practicing with her little 3-year-old daughter. She spoke simply, and I could practice while playing with her. But my dad was miserable the summer we hosted those French girls. He couldn't stand that they were so much more sophisticated than Mary and me. They were just very confident, wearing scarves, turning up their noses at his plastic bags of Stouffer's, and getting out all the pots and pans to cook. It drove him crazy how they dressed so well and talked with so much confidence and took over our house. He had to host them because that was part of the deal with the exchange program, but he was competitive. My sister and I would crack up because he was in such a bad mood that whole summer, just cranky. They would make all this French food, and then Amélie would throw it back up. She was so casual about it, even showing me how to do it, fingers down her throat, "Voilà, comme ça, vamise, la la," in her cute French accent, whistling while she mimed, "fingers down the throat." And Amélie would kind of boss our dad around with all her ideas. "Mr. Shannon, today we leave Cleveland. Maybe we hire a car and we drive to Chicago for the day. What do you think?" We got stopped by the police once for speeding, and Amélie said to us, "Ah, parlez français, speak French, speak French." So when the cop came to the window and said, "Driver's license," I told them, "Je ne parle pas anglais." Then we all spoke French together fast till he let us go. We did stuff like that for the whole summer. And my dad was just consumed with jealousy. But for Mary and me, it was a fun summer. We loved that we got to go around in the Chevy Malibu convertible with these wild and sophisticated French girls. They dominated town. Amélie was a natural beauty in an effortless way. Beatrice was more of a tomboy. Amélie couldn't care less about boys, but the boys just fell at her feet. Beatrice was almost like her girlfriend. The two of them, they were thick as thieves. George and Debbie were obsessed with Bette Midler, and particularly her film The Rose and its soundtrack. They were also dying to see Making Love, a scandalous movie at the time with a gay subplot, so I joined them. We all adored drama, and Deb and George were both in the closet back then, which made it extra fascinating. Deb told me later that she knew she was gay at this time and that she was in love with Bette Midler. Then she dated George briefly and imagined that he was Bette. She and George had so many loves in common that she fell in love with him. They'd met in class at their public school when someone shouted, "Janis Joplin," and George shouted back, "The Rose." Their adoration of Bette Midler brought them together. But in high school, George wasn't out of the closet yet. "I couldn't admit it to myself," he told me. "And though our feelings were romantic when we were little, we went to different schools for junior high and the first 2 years of high school. Then when he came to Hawken as a junior, he wanted to date me. I remember we went out one night downtown for dinner. Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic by The Police was playing. It was snowing, and we kissed a little when he dropped me off. But the next week at school, I wrote him a sweet little note saying that in my gut, he felt more like a brother or a friend and that it wasn't right. He wrote me back saying he was disappointed, but he understood. Debbie was from a big Italian family. I would go to the Palermo house all the time for big dinners, rigatoni with sausage, spaghetti and meatballs. I loved that house because everybody was so warm and affectionate, and their grandma lived with them too, all these generations together. There was all this cooking and love and laughter. Deb's family was very supportive of me. I also became very close to her little brother, Mike, and started to think of him as my adopted little brother. Mike told me I was, quote, the only friend of Debbie's that genuinely asked me questions about my life and truly seemed to care about my answers. I remember crying when you left because I couldn't stop thinking about you and how all I wanted to do was keep talking. Deb, George, and I took a trip to New York City when we were just old enough to be traveling on our own. We got a bus from Cleveland and stayed at the Milford Plaza right in Times Square, where you could get a room, dinner, cocktails, and breakfast all for $43. They had an ad that was always on TV showing bellhops, chambermaids, waiters, concierges, all carrying bags, making beds, lighting desserts on fire, and answering phones to Lullaby of Broadway. Everybody at Hawken had money and flew down to Florida for vacation. My dad didn't want Mary and me to feel left out, so even though he was deep in the red and struggling, he sent us to Palm Beach by ourselves. We stayed at this motel for elderly people called Testa's. I think it's been torn down, but in the 80s, it was the cheap place where lots of older women did long-term living. The rooms didn't have television sets, so Mary and I watched General Hospital every day on a communal TV down in the lobby with all the old people. Those were sweet memories with my sister. We both liked Testa's because it was like a step back in time, but we really bonded over the fact that we wanted to get a tan. We knew that if we went back to school tan, people would think we were rich kids who could afford to go to Palm Beach or Boca for vacation. We also used to walk over to the snazzy hotel, the Breakers, swim in their pool, and look at all the actual rich kids. They were just swimming in this giant pool beside the ocean, eating cheeseburgers and charging them to their rooms. God, I thought, they're so lucky to be rich. They can eat burgers by this big fancy pool and just take it for granted. My dad did come with us on other trips to Palm Beach and took us to this fancy restaurant with live piano music, Doherty's. We got baked potatoes and the best roasted chicken. We also had lunch with a woman my dad knew from Ohio. I told her I was planning to move to LA to become an actress, and she said, "Oh, honey, you cannot go to Los Angeles, not without your SAG card." As if it just wasn't possible. First I thought, really? Oh God, but then it just made me mad. My reaction was, I'm not going to listen to that. I always dismissed that kind of advice. I was tough. My dad would often take trips to Palm Beach by himself and stay at Testa's. Usually he wouldn't drink during those trips. He would have years and years of sobriety. But when my dad was drinking, he loved piano bars. One time he met a lady who was traveling around in her station wagon looking for work with a handwritten sign that said, "Have piano, will travel." She was the kind of character that I eventually did on Saturday Night Live. A woman in her 60s performing with her piano at resort town restaurants. An old showbiz gal looking for work. "Have piano, will travel." One of those kind of ladies. He took her out once, and after that, she would bang on his door. "Hey, Jim, you want to go get dinner tonight?" He called home to tell us about her. "Oh, my God, she's driving me crazy," he said. "She keeps knocking on my door to see if I'm free. I just want to tell her, give me some space." Another time, he met Elizabeth Taylor. She was doing the Little Foxes at the Parker Playhouse in Fort Lauderdale. Before big shows would go to Broadway or London, they'd try them out in small towns to iron out the wrinkles. He was drinking that time and managed to get invited into her dressing room after the show, saying, "I know Miss Taylor." She let him in, saying, "Have a drink and get out." On another of these trips, just me and him, my dad drank too much. He dropped me off after dinner and then he went back out to the clubs in West Palm Beach by himself. After he returned late, I woke up and saw him sitting up on his bed with a cigarette dangling from his lips, a big ash hanging off the end of it. He hadn't noticed the ash and was just dozing off. I took the cigarette, put it out, snapped him out of it. "You could have set this place on fire. Go to bed, please." It was dawn. I felt so angry, I just ran as fast as I could down the beach, crying to get my anger out. It was such a release. I didn't know what to do, and it felt so good to just run as fast as I could. Hours later, after he woke up, we sat down and had a serious conversation. I said, "It's so upsetting to see you drunk like that. It's scary. Please, I beg of you, please go back and talk to those people at AA." My dad was not defensive. He felt terrible. "You're right, Molly," he said. I got through to him and he listened to me. But it also felt unfair that I even had to say it, that it had to come to this. In high school, I always had to babysit to make money, and I missed a lot of parties. My dad would tell me, "Oh, it's just a party. Don't worry. There will always be more parties." But I had this anxious feeling about missing parties. On the occasions when I did go, I couldn't get there fast enough. I would longingly think the love of my life might be at that party, and I need to get there now. And what my dad said about parties wasn't actually true. High school ended, and there were no more of those parties. I learned how to be comfortable with Mickey Covington, though George Cheeks was my first true love. But before Mickey and George, I loved bad boys. Like, literally convicts. I started liking bad boys when I was little. When Mary and I were kids, our dad would take us to the juvenile jail and visit the boys who were locked up there. My dad told us, "We're going to go because these boys don't have any family and they need a big brother type. They need somebody to listen to them and talk to them." The jail was fenced in with barbed wire and it had a big smokestack. I remember there was smoke coming out of it as we walked up and I wondered, do they send the really bad boys up in smoke? I even asked my dad, did they burn them and then smoke them out? We brought the bad boys brown bags of cigarettes, Lay's potato chips, and Doritos. We would sit with them and talk, and they'd smoke, and my dad would listen. It was one of his ways of being a good Catholic. The prisoners were young, no more than 17 years old. They wore T-shirts, and I liked their cigarettes. My sister and I said to each other, "This is fascinating." And I thought, wow, these boys are bad. Like a boy who'd been held back in first grade with me, Patrick Byrne. He was friends with Anne's brother. And one time when we all went to Mrs. Ramp's cabin, Patrick just sneaked into bed with Anne and me. She felt his hairy legs and shouted, "Patrick!" He was very developed to have such hairy legs. We hadn't gone through puberty. For some reason, my dad called him Marty, and my dad thought he was amazing. "Oh, that Marty Byrne, he is just so charming." I just thought, Patrick Byrne is bad. He was very charming to adults, but would then turn around and do these deviant things like Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver. Patrick also had redeeming qualities, even when he was technically bullying people. When he saw the mean note about my mom being dead that Billy Fox passed me, he organized a bunch of kids from our class to kick Billy's ass. They cornered Billy, who was weeping, cowering, and Patrick said, "How could you do that to Molly? That is terrible. If you ever hurt Molly again in any way, I swear to God, I'll fucking kill you." He has my back, I thought. He's got balls. I felt protected. Allison and all the kids hugged me and said, "It's okay, Molly." Billy was scared to death. Once Patrick used a tree in my backyard to scale three floors and break into my bedroom window. I loved it. He came crashing in, pulled down his pants, penis totally erect, and said, "You know, hold it." I wrote in my diary, "Oh yeah, diary, here's some juicy info. I have a mad crush on Patrick, but I don't think he really likes me, especially my chest, but he does call me once in a while." My best friend is Allison. I love my daddy and my sis. Anne Ranft is my other best friend. My dream for today is to be a fantastic gymnast. Well, that's all, diary. Bye-bye. I just really wanted Patrick to kiss me. I had a fantasy that we could be like Bonnie and Clyde. But at the same time, he wanted to do all this dirty stuff like pull down his pants and attack girls. I would have loved to have gone on dates with him, but he was too busy attacking other young women. He really enjoyed breaking into my babysitting jobs. He was really bad. His dad was a cop who used to beat him with chains, and his mother was completely passive because she was so scared of her husband. He later accumulated quite an aggravated robbery record and went to prison for trying to kill his girlfriend's father for money. He would write me letters from prison about his tattoos. When he was in prison, he changed, hardened. It was a scary change. He went from a funny, handsome, charismatic kid to a convict. It was scary how fast he turned bad. He got chain link inked around his neck. At one point, he broke out and was found with an arsenal of weapons in his house, went back to jail, escaped again, and was caught with more weapons in his car. In one of the letters he sent me from prison, Patrick described his life. I must explain. I can't tell you my crime in detail because my case is still being pursued by detectives in Shaker. No person knows what really happened. I'm still being questioned and writing statements. I can tell you my charges, though. 1, 2 counts of attempted murder. 2, aggravated burglary. 3, grand theft. So you see, I'm not the angel I was thought to be, Molly. You're partially right about my innocence. Things will work out for you, I hope. Life in here has given me a different aspect of life out there in general. You'll see the different person I am. People will be on guard of me, but I still have a good personality. This was the type of person I was attracted to when I was little. He made my heart pound. He was dangerous, a real bad boy. Though later I wrote in my diary, I've decided I don't like Patrick anymore because he has no patience or courtesy. I heard he was eventually killed in a high-speed car chase on his way to murder a girl. This was a real person. Chapter 8. Leaving. In high school, there were achievement tests for admission to special classes, which were helpful for college, and I was interested. But to take the test, I needed to bring a check into school. I couldn't pay in cash. My babysitting money was no good. I didn't bother asking my dad, oh, would you mind writing a check for me to take this test? Because I knew it would just stress him out. By then, I had learned to not ask for too much. If he did give me something, he would hold it over me. There would be all these strings attached. It made me very independent. I just wanted to make my own money. My dad didn't give a shit about school. He was the total opposite of any parent you would ever meet. His opinion about cheating on tests was, try to cheat if there is any way. He always told me, if you can cheat or find the answers or give yourself an extra day, do that. In 10th grade, I was stressed out studying for a test, and he asked, can't you just find a copy of the test so you can cheat or stay home from school and study more? He did not care about grades. He felt that a combination of social ability, street smarts, understanding how to make a buck, asking people questions, being charming, and showing an interest in others would get you a lot further in life than academic achievement. That's what he encouraged in me, what I guess my mother saw in me from the beginning. Sometimes I would be up until 3 o'clock in the morning studying down in my basement, drinking Taster's Choice instant coffee to stay awake. And he'd say, Molly, please go to bed, go to bed. But I was a very disciplined student, hardworking. I wanted to do really well, and I got all A's. But when I got really stressed out, he would put his foot down and say, let's just call in sick and we can drive downtown and we'll go out for lunch and then you can just get a copy of the test from someone the next day. I'd relent and say, oh, that's a great idea. Then I'd cut school so we could drive along the lake to the spot on the west side where there were these swing sets, and we would sit swinging, talking, swinging some more and have the best time. We'd go out and get chili and crackers at this old-fashioned coffee shop. It just took the edge off. Or sometimes we'd just stay home and watch old movies. My dad admired strong female performers. He loved Easter Parade with Judy Garland and National Velvet with Elizabeth Taylor. He always wanted to hang out with me, and he loved it if I cut school. My dad saw a picture in our local newspaper and showed everyone. Look at this picture of Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet. That looks like Molly. Look at this. He cut the picture out and saved it. Once Mary and I were both in high school, we started to do the typical teenage drinking at keg parties with our friends. Our dad figured teens are probably going to drink no matter what, so he didn't forbid it. He figured keeping an open line of communication was better than laying down the law, and that if we ever did need his help for any reason, we could call him or talk to him. He would always say, "Please, girls, whatever you do, call me if you've had a couple beers. I will happily come pick you up, but don't ever drink and drive. Please, never." And we listened. We were really good kids. We would drink a little, but we would never drive. Then he bought us candies, high heels, and $10,000 mink coats he got on discount, saying, "I want my girls to look glamorous and sophisticated in church. Doll yourselves up." My mink was two-tone. I brought my candies to school and wore them with my uniform. One of the mothers who volunteered as a librarian just looked at me and shook her head and said, "Oh, your dad never should have bought you those shoes. Those are prostitute shoes." I said, "Well, Jim Shannon thinks they're sexy and elegant." Then my dad gave me my mom's old triple shank diamond cluster ring to wear. I put on my candies and my two-tone mink, and we went to a downtown gay bar called Tracks. I actually loved it. Mary liked it too. He was off the wagon and we were his show ponies. It felt like New York City. We drank beer and wore mink coats, and my dad would also party with my friends. One time he went to Tracks with Allison and me. She was all decked out in a long khaki trench coat, and after a while, as it got drunker and drunker, it just became a rowdy scene. I said, "You guys are getting too crazy and wild. I'm going to go home and I'm going to bed." My dad and Allison went on drinking until they decided to head to the bar next door. My dad tried to walk out with his drink, but the bouncer stopped him. My dad got mad, poked the big bouncer in the chest in a kind of silly Three Stooges way to make Allison laugh. "Hey, listen, Buster, you don't tell me what I can and cannot do." They both walked to the bar next door and danced to the jukebox. Then later, my dad got his car, came back to the bar with a bouncer, and blocked the entrance so no one could get in or come out. Allison loved how bold he was. She got a kick out of his outrageousness. She was very close to my dad. She would always say, "Your dad and me were like two peas in a pod." Her father, a plastic surgeon, was quiet and intellectual. But when my dad wasn't drinking and acting crazy, she could really talk to him. Mary headed east to attend Mount Vernon College in Washington, D.C. When she came back to Cleveland for Christmas break, my dad and I picked her up from the airport. We wanted to hear each other's stories, but we could not tell our stories in the car. We had to wait till we sat down, ordered a glass of wine, ordered some food. Only then could we begin our stories. It was a ritual. It was so sweet. And with Mary away, my dad decided to do wild things with me all the time. He'd say, "How about you cut school, call in sick, and we'll take a mystery trip?" And without even packing our bags, we would go to the airport and look at the boards in the main concourse. "Let's see, there's San Francisco, there's Palm Beach. Let's go to Palm Beach, Florida." And we would get on the plane with no luggage in the middle of a school day, pay on the plane with a credit card, People Express, arrive in Palm Beach, and just stay at a hotel. We'd go to thrift shops to buy clothes. Mystery trips. I once cut school for a whole week, borrowed a bathing suit from the woman who worked behind the desk at the Holiday Inn in West Palm Beach. It had really big cups, and I wore it to the beach. On mystery trips, my father was the most fun to hang out with. On mystery trips, he was like a fun brother father. But he could always flip. One time we went to Palm Beach, and when we got there, he said, "Oh, this is costing me so much, and I didn't want to pay for it." I said, "Then don't offer to pay for it." He would tell me things that I shouldn't have known, too private, sexual stuff. Between a daughter and her single father, lines could be blurred. Like any family with codependency issues, sometimes you don't know what's appropriate or what isn't. Boundaries weren't defined. I was the person he relied upon emotionally. I think he needed my companionship. Once, talking about a woman he was dating, he blurted out, "Oh God, I'm not good in bed. I come too fast." I had no idea what to say. I just asked him, "Well, can't you just slow down?" Another time I read my dad a letter from a boyfriend that said, "I want to draw hieroglyphics on your body and sweat." Look, isn't that sweet? I asked. But my dad was so uncomfortable. I had taken it too far. He didn't like it at all. He was still my father. It crossed the line. When it was time to apply to college, I went for a meeting at Hawken with this jock-type guy who for some reason was the college counselor. He was supposed to tell me what schools I should consider, but he was so unhelpful and discouraging. I guess he didn't understand creative kids or kids who wanted to be in the arts or girls. He just said, I don't know, maybe check out like Ohio State or Ohio University. I remember feeling angry. I had really good grades. I wanted to go to school in New York City, but all he could suggest were schools in Ohio. When I left that meeting, I was so mad that I took the big, thick college guidebook, the one with all the schools in it, and I threw it down the empty school hallway. I thought, I'm not going to listen to anything this guy says. My dad left the college application process up to me. So on my own, I went through that big, thick college guide, found NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, and circled it. I thought, I like this school, this drama school, New York University. This is where I want to go. My dad just said, okay, apply, do it. NYU did regional drama auditions at a big hotel in Chicago, and applicants were expected to present monologues. Monologues? I didn't even know what a monologue was. I went to the library and found a book called Monologues for Teachers. Stuff like, good morning, boys and girls. My name is Mrs. Crimmins, and today we're going to be turning to page 23 in our textbooks. I'm not sure this is going to be good, I thought, but I still checked out the book. That's how green I was. I did eventually find some actual monologues, really dramatic ones, because I loved drama. My dad, Mr. O'Neill, Allison, and I made a road trip out of my audition. It was so exciting. At this big Chicago hotel, they were also holding Yale and Juilliard auditions. We saw all these high school kids practicing their monologues. They were nervous, pacing, talking to themselves, preparing for their big auditions. It was just like in the movies. It was like fame. This is so cool, I thought. These are the top drama students from all over the country auditioning for Yale and Juilliard and NYU. Just this alone is so cool to get here and see all this. My audition was for the head of the NYU drama department, Evangeline Morfos. I performed this dark, intense monologue from Agnes of God where I had to scream, Mommy, Mommy, don't burn me, please, Mommy. The button had fallen off my corduroys and I was holding them up with a safety pin, which popped open in the middle of my monologue and stuck me in the stomach. The pain added to the intensity. And I knew I had done a good job. After my performance, we sat and talked. She said, what a great monologue. Well done. She was just very warm and kind. And I got in. When I saw that big envelope arrive at my house in Shaker Heights, Ohio, I opened it up and it said, you have been accepted to New York University. I could not believe it. New York City, here I come. My dad and I went out to celebrate that night. We decided to go to an art house theater and see this movie about Andy Warhol's scene called Chow Manhattan, starring Edie Sedgwick. And I thought, this is so cool. This is what my life is going to be like in the Big Apple. Cool and artsy and creative. Part 2. Freedom. Chapter 9. Drama School. I moved to New York and started classes at NYU in the fall of 1984. My dad and my sister Mary dropped me off. We were pulling up to Hayden Hall, my dorm, when all of a sudden two men came out of nowhere and right in front of our car, one of them hit the other over the head with a baseball bat. We screamed and the man who got hit fell onto our windshield. Then a cop ran over and pointed his gun straight at our car. My dad screamed, "Duck!" A few minutes later, all of us shaking, my dad said, goodbye, Molly. Have a wonderful time at NYU. After I was gone, my dad was devastated. When Mary had left for college, he'd had a hard time, but he'd still had me at home. He'd relied on me even more. Now he was all alone. He missed me, and it was very heavy. He had lost his trusted companion. But I was ready for my own life and wanted to go, so we had to find other people to rely on. He had to learn how to let me go. I was ready to not be so dependent on him. He was not ready for that. I was ready to move toward a healthier place. He would have been happy to keep things the way they were. It was hard for both of us. At college, I felt like I was a divorcee. It was like, I'm free, yippee! I felt as if I'd gotten out of a long, crazy marriage, emotionally speaking. I just wanted to put on my character shoes and do monologues in Southern accents saying, Mama, oh Mama. And dating was not a priority. I was not ready to be involved. I had been my dad's primary companion for years, and the last thing I wanted to do now was have a boyfriend. Dating wasn't really something that I did in a serious way until much later. I had to really work on myself to have boyfriends and form normal relationships. At the end of high school, just before I left for NYU, I'd met this boy named Tom Lux, who went to the public high school in Shaker Heights. He was really popular, really nice, and he was cute. He was also really into me. I thought, oh no, he thinks I'm one of those normal girls, but I've tricked him. He doesn't know that I'm a freak or that I'm scared. I appear normal, but I'm not. He doesn't know my dark past. We went to a dance together, and I was so nervous to get close to him while we were slow dancing. I wondered, how do people get close and kiss and, like, get together? I had avoided that at all costs because I never wanted to get my heart shattered again. My thoughts went like this. I'm not getting close to anybody. Nope, I'm not going to do that. I'm not giving my heart to anybody. Nope, not a chance. I did that once with my mom when I was little, and that did not lead to good things, so I am not doing that again. No way. I could play along for a while, but then I knew I'm going to push you away because I think you think I'm normal, and I'm not. I am a freak. At NYU, I went from being at a small, private, preppy school where everybody knew everybody's story to this big, diverse university. My roommate was a girl in the nursing department. She was very bright and also a little nerdy. People said things about her like, your roommate's eccentric. Some people think she's like a real witch. But I thought to myself, I can do whatever I want. I can be friends with whoever I want. I'm going to be friends with the freaks and the geeks, and I don't have to fit into any special clique, and I'm free, and I like that witch. And you know what? I'm going to be friends with that witch, and she and I are going to go to the East Village for Chinese food on Sunday night. We're going to split a bottle of wine and sit and talk, that sweet, smart witch and I, and that is that. While I was at NYU, George Cheeks was at Yale. We used to take the train back and forth, New Haven to New York, to visit each other all the time. One time he came down and we ate fajitas at Panchito's, this Mexican place in the village. After we were done, I said, we're both broke students. We really should dine and dash to save money. George had never done anything like that, but he was game. Let's do it, he said. So we did it. And the entire staff, managers, chef, cooks, waiters, chased us down the street. A mob of people came out and took off after us, holding pots and pans. They caught George first, and I just kept on running. But he just said, oh, so sorry, did I not pay? Sorry about that. And did such a good job pretending like he totally forgot that the whole thing just blew over. And they left us alone. We were dying laughing, just in hysterics, on McDougal Street. Then when I visited George that first year at Yale, he asked me to pretend I was having sex with him. We slept in the same bed as friends. After we went into his room, I made these loud moaning sounds like we were really going at it. And when we came out in the morning, his suite mates high-fived him as if to be like, hey, man, you got some. It made George happy, and I was thrilled to play along. But by the time he was a junior at Yale, he was dating a guy from Spain called Manolo. When I turned 20 that September, my dad visited, and we went to the Oak Bar in the Plaza Hotel to celebrate. After the waiter came to our table, my dad ordered vodka neat with a glass of ice. He called that a sidecar. My dad liked the Oak Bar atmosphere, but it was really expensive. So the second the waiter turned his back, he drank down the vodka like a shot and refilled his glass with water really fast. I was so busy watching my dad refilling the glass, I wasn't able to see his face and how in the world he managed not to pucker his lips after drinking all that vodka. Then my dad called the waiter back and said, I just took a sip and this is watered down. I think it's just water. The surly waiter sniffed it suspiciously and brought more, but this time he came with the bottle so my dad could see him pour it. Stoli. Then we went to see La Cage aux Folles, and after that to Don't Tell Mamas for after theater drinks. The last time I'd seen him drinking, I had asked him, "Why do you have to drink? Can't you just have fun with just me? Aren't I enough?" And he'd said, "No, it's not that. I just feel like I put on rose-colored glasses, and I see the world in a nice pink glow, you know?" And I thought, I don't really get it, but all right. Now I just thought, if you can't beat him, join him. I wasn't really in the mood to drink, but we partied the whole day. I could not keep up with my dad. I remember being so drunk that I went to the bathroom at some restaurant and passed out. I was a little lightweight. As I lay on the floor, a woman came in and yelled, "You, get up! Get out of here!" I stumbled back into the bar, and then we both got kicked out physically, like bums, like in a cartoon. "You and your daughter, get out of here!" Then my dad pulled out his camera, taking pictures and shouting, "I work for the New York Times, and I will report this establishment." The next time I went home, he showed me all these pictures of the staff hiding their faces. At NYU, a lot of students didn't have to work the way I did, and so they could take advantage of drama school by doing plays. I didn't have the time to even audition for anything, let alone rehearse if I got a part, because I was on financial aid and working 30 hours a week selling health club memberships and answering phones as a receptionist. I did that job for years. I could never even pick up a phone without automatically saying, "Park Avenue Squash and Fitness, this is Molly, can I help you?" I had to pull my own weight. So I worked at this health club and was a full-time college student. I went to all my classes, of course, but I wasn't taking full advantage of NYU Tisch. And obviously, there was no time for dating in all of this. I also worked in restaurants. I was a coat check girl at the old Homestead Steakhouse where all the waiters were professionals who'd been there for decades. Suki, the manager, wore bright red lipstick and black bell-bottom pants and spent her time in the kitchen counting all the cash. And the career waiters would always be sliding their fingers along this ledge up by the ceiling to get the drugs they'd hidden there. They'd dose up on Valium or whatever else before they started their shift to take the edge off. I also started waiting tables at the Horn and Hard Art Dinomat on the Upper East Side. It was a 1950s nostalgia place with a big jukebox where all the waitresses had to do little doo-wop and teeny bopper performances. We would stop whatever we were doing and just do these memorized songs and dances. To make the time go faster, my coworkers and I bought really long, fake ponytails and took on different personas. At the end of the night, we'd sing songs from Annie and dream about a better life while we wiped down the tables to close up the shop. But the second I heard the opening notes to Bobby Lewis's Tossin' and Turnin', I'd head down to the walk-in freezer and hide till the song was over. I would sit on the frozen turkeys and eat little orange slices while I waited. Nobody knew about my secret little hiding spot until one day I got caught by a manager. One of the regular customers was this old guy, Elliot. He told me one day, "I want to help you and be like your manager. Let me take you out for dinner and we can talk about it." I didn't have any money at the time and I thought, he can be like my sugar daddy. So I let him take me out to Barbetta, one of the oldest Italian restaurants in the theater district. I ate all this delicious pasta. When the meal was over, he wanted me to hold his hand. I thought, whatever, I'll hold his hand. Who cares? It's not that bad. It's kind of worth holding his hand for this delicious spaghetti carbonara. After that, he took me out for dinner a bunch of times. He would show up at the Dinomat and tell people, "I'm her talent manager." I went to his apartment once, and there were all these Irish girls living with him who wanted to be working actresses. But in the meantime, I found out they were giving him blowjobs. He covered their rent and paid for their headshots, and they got a free place to live. When I realized all that, I felt so bad for the girl stuck there living with this creep, and I just thought, he is disgusting. Freshman year, I took classes with a legendary drama teacher named Terry Hayden. She had a cane, she was tough, she'd tell students, "You're gonna make it, you're never gonna make it." People were scared of her, she could break you. Terry taught sense memory, which was a very popular acting technique. During what she called a private moment exercise in class, she would ask students to get up and recall an emotional, personal experience from childhood. The exercise was designed to help actors feel they were in private while in a public space, to shed the self-consciousness that sometimes inhibits an actor's performance. For the exercise, we had to be very detailed and specific in reconstructing our memories, answering all sorts of questions for Terry. She gave us 10 minutes to experience the space, and then she would ask us detailed questions. Where are you? How are you feeling? What do you smell? Do you see the oriental rug? What does it feel like to touch the rug? Tell me. If you were really emotionally available and if your instrument was free and ready, Terry would then have you launch into performing whatever monologue you'd prepared once she deemed you were in the right emotional place. If you were vulnerable and cried in front of the class when she went through her probing questions, it was like, bravo. If you were bullshitting and pretending to be emotional and had walls up, Terry would call you out in this deadpan way. Nope. Fake. You're acting. I don't believe it. Kind of like my dad. We all desperately wanted her approval. It was like a therapy session. One girl got up and did an exercise recalling her grandmother's funeral. I thought to myself, your grandmother's funeral? Then I thought to myself, ooh, baby, I think I've got juicier material than this. When it was my turn, Terry put me in front of the class and asked me questions about my parents and what life had been like when I was little. She was caring. She was careful. Her questions made me cry. I was open. I wasn't afraid. And it felt good to let it all out. She said, oh, my darling. Oh, my sweet girl. Now, if you can access that, and I see that you can, it's going to be great. You have so much to pull from. After class, my fellow drama students came up and hugged me. They were really supportive and loving. But the moment that really clicked for me was when we had to be clowns, or Arlecchino, the comic relief from Italian Commedia dell'arte plays. It was the final big project in this class taught by Alan Langdon, who ran NYU's professional acting program and was affiliated with Circle in the Square, a Broadway theater. All the students were supposed to research the subject on our own. Weeks and weeks of research. We also had to sew ourselves a fake penis to use as a prop and do a 5 to 7 minute routine. It's very acrobatic, too. Arlecchino needs to come out and entertain a whole huge theater, so whatever he does has to be big and broad and always based around lotzi, the Italian word for slapstick gags, which are broken down into beats of three, meaning that if you fell down, you didn't just get back up, you did it again and again, always in threes. And this one performance would be our whole grade for the semester. Other people in the class were renting out entire warehouse spaces to rehearse. I was like, really? You mean you're actually renting out a giant warehouse to practice your Arlecchino? Oh, God, I haven't practiced my Arlecchino at all, I thought. It was starting to make me nervous. But deep down in my heart, I knew. This is a big comic performance, and I don't think it should be too rehearsed. It should be spontaneous and organic. When my big performance day finally came, I had not rehearsed at all. The only thing I had done, which was sew my fake penis, which I have to say was really fun. I remember standing outside the door to the classroom before I began, heart pounding, no idea what I was going to do for the 6 minutes that were going to decide my whole grade for the semester. I was just scared shitless. But then I reminded myself, it's okay, Molly, that you don't have it all worked out. It's okay. I knew I would have to be brave and take chances as a performer. When I stepped into the room to begin, I went crazy. I did my first lotso trying to get through the door, succeeding the third time. The physical sequences can be improvised with exaggerated reactions. So I decided to just spontaneously fall into the trash can that just happened to be in our theater class that day. Then, of course, it was very hard to get back out of that trash can. And naturally, I waved that penis around. Then I pulled Alan, the teacher, into the scene to improvise with him. The students love this, teasing the teacher and kind of giving him a hard time. In real life, he was pretty serious, so I decided to kind of fuck with him as the character. And the students loved it. I could get away with it as the Arlecchino, kind of ribbing him like, ooh, you think you're such a big deal, the big, tough acting teacher. I was improvising in character, but I used my real feelings, my slightly suspicious feelings of his know-it-all quality. and I just went completely wild. Something clicked and I went crazy, improvising a big, wild, comedic performance. The class was crying laughing. In the end, I didn't just get a standing ovation. The whole class stood up on their chairs, cheering. It was a turning point in my life. With that Arlecchino, I found myself as an artist and a performer. I learned I can make people really laugh. I learned to trust myself, that somewhere deep in my gut, I knew not to over-rehearse, but to just let it rip. Know the basic beats, but then let yourself be free within those parameters, which is what I ended up doing years later on SNL. During my semester in New York, I had a scene study partner named Gina Costello. She called me Mal. Mal! After we got paired up to do a scene together, we decided we'd meet to get to know each other. She asked if I could meet her at a hotel bar in Times Square. At first, I tried to protest. Get to know each other and work on our scene in a Times Square bar? Seems kind of strange. But then she insisted and then slipped in, well, I mean, maybe we can get some nice rich guy to buy us drinks or something. Come on, Mal. I said, I can lend you money if you need money. But then I said, all right, and just decided to go along with it. We met at the bar, and within 5 minutes, we were getting free drinks from a Saudi sheik. He was flirting like crazy with Gina. You look like a princess, he told her. After we downed a few free gin and tonics, I left to go to the ladies' room. Gina followed after a few minutes. When she walked in, she was so excited she could hardly speak. Mal, guess what?
What?
You're not going to believe this.
What?
Well, he said he knows we're students and he wants to help us out.
What?
She gave me this, don't you get it, stare. He knows we're students and he wants to help us out.
Wink.
I didn't get it. Gina lifted her eyebrows.
He wants us to come up to his room, Mal?
What? It won't take too long. 15 minutes is all. Please, Mal, please.
That's like prostitution.
Mal, please, please. I want a new stereo so badly.
Gina, I just can't.
Okay, I'll tell you what. How about you just come up to the room with us? You don't have to do anything. I promise. Just come up and give me some support.
Gina, if you want to go up there, that's fine. I'll just wait in the bar for you.
But what if something happens to me?
Please, Mal. You got to come up to the room.
She kept going on like this until I was feeling so guilty and worried that if something happened to her, it would be my fault that I finally agreed to come up to the room. We went back to the bar and then up to a suite on the 20th floor. Gina told the guy that I was a virgin to keep him away from me. He was thrilled and he shouted, "You're a virgin!" I was treasured goods. But then he leaped on top of me, kissing ecstatically. He actually pushed me onto the bed so I was on my back. It wasn't violent or anything, but I could feel his weight on me till Gina hoisted him off and shouted, "No, no, leave her alone. Don't touch her. She's a virgin. Get off of her." I was very, very innocent. We were tipsy. We did this silly strip tease for him, bouncing on the bed and taking our tops off. I thought, this is so weird and crazy. I kept reminding myself, this is a wild city you've chosen to live in, Molly. New York City, crazy adventures, stuff like this happens in New York. But then he started taking his clothes off. He had this pot belly. I ran into the bathroom and put on my top. When I came back out, Gina was giving him a blowjob. He was in ecstasy. I thought, I'm a Catholic girl. Gina is a naughty girl. She did not seem concerned with my presence at all. She seemed like a professional. I went back into the bathroom. After a few minutes, she came in too. I told her, I'm sorry, but I've got to get out of here. She said, just give me 5 minutes. 5 minutes, please, just 5 minutes. That's it. I promise. I won't go. Promise, promise, promise. 5 minutes. All right, that's it. I twiddled my fingers in the bathroom for a while, but when the sheik began moaning in pleasure, I walked back into the room. Gina looked up from underneath him, gave me a little friendly wave, and held up 3 fingers to indicate how much longer it was going to take. The sheik didn't notice that I was in the room because his back was to me. I wasn't even really fazed. I started putting on my coat.
Come on, let's get out of here. I signaled to her, waving my hands. Let's wrap this up. Come on. Enough was enough. Gina shook her head and mouthed, check his wallet. Check his wallet. His wallet. I quickly went through all his clothes. I'd never done anything like that before. It felt wrong, but I wanted to get out of there fast. In the end, all I could find in his pockets was a $5 bill and a $10 bill. So I quickly grabbed some hotel stationery and wrote in big block capitals, just a 5 and a 10. Let's go! And I held up the piece of paper so she could read it from across the room. She took the hint and got out from under him. He ended up having a secret stash of cash somewhere in the closet and giving us $600 each from a big wad. We took a cab home in the pouring rain, and she was mad that we'd been given equal shares. I can't believe we both got the same amount. I had to do all the dirty work. You didn't even do anything. She wanted some of my half, but eventually relented. Then you have to pay for the cab ride home, Mal. It's only fair. I'm going to take my boyfriend out to celebrate, she said. I felt numb. I felt dirty, but I was fine paying for the cab. You're going to tell your boyfriend about tonight? I asked. Oh, yeah, he'll get such a kick out of it. I don't think he'll think it's very funny. The driver let Gina off first, and then he started flirting with me. About 2 days later, another very good NYU drama school friend, Ruby, called me up and said, "You are not going to believe what just happened to me last night." Immediately, I knew. "Oh, I bet I can believe it," I said. Ruby was a super serious, brilliant actress. She told me she'd wound up trapped in a hotel bathroom reading Man and Superman for her theater history class. This time, Gina told her trick that Ruby was her personal bodyguard. When he refused to pay her, she ran into the bathroom and asked Ruby to run back out there and get her clothes. To keep her distance, Ruby scooped up Gina's clothes with the tip of an umbrella like Mary Poppins. Then Gina made Ruby go back out there and say, "We want cab fare home." And then he said, "I ain't giving you nothing." Gina was 18 that night in Times Square. I think about her from time to time, and I hope she's doing well.